So what I'll do is hand over straight away to Philip Hayes from Shirley, who will speak to us on the subject, God's Answer to World Problems.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for the warm welcome. Quite literally, I mean, it's such a lovely day, isn't it? We've noticed this thing, actually, that the sunniest part of the week, without exception, seems to be between around 10 o'clock and half 12 on a Sunday. And at Shirley, we like to call this our weekly test of faith. So hopefully you'll all stay awake and fairly cool in here. We're going to make it quite interactive, so if anyone is thinking of having a nap, then just be aware that I might call on you to answer a question. So I want to talk a little bit about problems. First of all, let's just find out. Put your hand up if you haven't got any problems at all. No one? One person? Okay. All right, good. So we can all relate to this then, this idea that there's always some sort of problem in our life, isn't there? Whether it's maybe someone in your family who's ill and you're worried about their health. Maybe it's an elderly relative and you're worried about how they're getting on. Perhaps there's problems at work and you're not quite sure how you're going to deal with those. Maybe you're worried about the security of your job and being able to provide for yourself and for your family if you have one. So there's lots of things that we can choose to worry about because it seems that the world kind of throws one problem at us after another. So I want to start with a quick review of the year so far and have a look at some of the problems that we've seen in the world around us. Now, when I last did this talk, it was back at the start of the year and we reviewed the whole of 2016. But we're going to make it a little bit quicker. We're going to look at a few news stories. So I'm going to put up a photo of the news story. We're going to work backwards from now to the start of the year, and shout out when you know what the event is that the picture represents. And they start easier, and obviously as time goes on and we get back further, it gets a little bit harder. So, what about this one?
Grenfell Tower.
We all know this, right? It's in the news still, isn't it? So this is the absolute disaster in the Tower housing block down in London. And we've been reading recently, haven't we, some more detail that's been uncovered on this, how warnings were ignored, how the materials used were not fit for purpose, and it does seem like it's a disaster that could have been prevented. So what about this photo, this news story?
Notre Dame.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. So this is the attack outside Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. So the assailant attacked a police officer and then was subsequently killed by the police. And the photograph is the tourists who and visitors who were locked inside the cathedral to keep them safe while this was happening. Okay, so what about this one?
Borough Market.
Yeah, Borough Market or the London Bridge attack, as it's been known, but yeah, beginning on London Bridge and heading into Borough Market afterwards. So here, you know, in the UK, in England, a terrorist attack on our own soil. And, you know, what a horrible event that was to read about. So what about this one? I put a massive clue in this one for you.
Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, not long before the attack we've just looked at, this is the Manchester Arena bombing. Now, I work in this industry, in the live music and events industry, so coming in the morning, this one seemed to hit everyone in the company. People either knew people that worked at that venue, maybe not for that particular event, but had worked there or been involved in other events by the same event organisers. And I didn't expect this. I sort of read about it on the news, and I walked into the office, and someone was just sat there and said, "It's just horrible, isn't it?" And I didn't know what he was referring to, whether it was my clothes or something. And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you know, the news in Manchester." I was like, "Of course, yes, absolutely horrible." And, you know, on the way home, I noticed there was a memorial set up outside the town hall in Birmingham. So that one really sort of hit home. Perhaps a bit more lighthearted, but serious nonetheless. What about this one?
Make the bar smaller.
Oh, do you know, that would have been a better one, wouldn't it? I think that was actually from last year or the year before. And yeah, I haven't quite got over what they did to Toblerone. No, this was Kit Kat foiled in their trademark attempt. So this one was Nestle trying to trademark the shape of a Kit Kat bar, I'm being told that you can't because a four-finger design has no inherent distinctiveness. So not quite so lighthearted, but the picture's perhaps not as devastating to look at as some of the others. Anyone know what this news story was?
The ocean.
Sorry, second?
Plastics in the ocean.
Yes, but specifically in one place. Anyone remember this one?
Yes, in an uninhabited island, which is...
That's right.
You've got the most plastic rock upon the shore.
Yeah, and... Square. I mean, here's the number. 38 million pieces of plastic waste found on an uninhabited South Pacific island. You know, I thought my children's bedrooms were bad. But this is something else, isn't it? So there's around 18 tonnes of plastic piling up on this island that no one even lives on. It's horrible, really. Okay, so one or two more.
Cyber attack.
Yeah, so this was the ransomware cyber attack, which hit nearly 100 countries around the world and, you know, had a knock-on effect. It wasn't just a problem with computers, it affected people, didn't it? People that were waiting for operations that had to go into hospital for various reasons. So, actually, that is the last one, because, in fact, does anyone know the date of this? Anyone remember? Roughly. So I said I'd work backwards from now. So what are we on now? The 18th of June. And I've gone through those news stories and we've got back as far as the 12th of May. Okay, and I decided to stop there because we've done just over a month and I didn't want to bore you. So we've only gone back that far. But I don't know, is it just me or does it seem that there's more happening like this in the world at the moment? It's terrorist attacks in the UK would be a good example because I didn't go back as far as the one that happened outside the House of Parliament. Do you remember that one? And then just the other day, wasn't someone arrested carrying some knives outside, again, the same location. So it just seems that everywhere you look in our country and around the world, there is something bad happening. Now, we haven't got time to look at all of these in detail. We're going to have a look at two problems this morning. We're going to have a look at these things in a little bit more detail, and then we're going to look at how the Bible has an answer to those problems. Because it certainly seems that all of the attempts made by people to try and solve these problems don't really work. You know, it might work temporarily or actually can make the situation worse in many cases. And particularly think about that example of all of the waste found on that island in the Pacific. None of that waste was formed naturally, was it? That was all man-made waste. So that's a problem created by humans, and humans are now trying to solve that problem by trying to clean up the plastics. And I don't know, actually, on that subject, did anyone read the study on sea salt? And maybe no one has as much spare time as me. But there was a study on sea salt, and they looked at about 30-odd grams of sea salt, and they looked at what was actually in it, and all except one contained plastics from the ocean. That's what we're eating. So it's horrible, really. So we're going to look at two problems. We're going to have a look at war or violence, you know, that sort of thing, and we're going to have a look at hunger. We'll look at those two things in a bit of detail, and then have a look at what the Bible's got to say about those. So let's start with war. I thought this was kind of a good one, because war or violence in different countries is just so topical at the moment with three terrorist attacks in the UK this year alone. But let's have a start with some facts and have a look at how war or armed conflict affects people. So the UN categorises armed conflict in terms of the number of violent deaths per year. So there are currently 18 ongoing armed conflicts which resulted in over 1,000 deaths in the last year. And there are 37, although this number might have changed from last night, which resulted in fewer than 1,000 deaths in the last year. So where in the world is this conflict taking place? So have a look at this. Just try and remember, if you can just remember 20 or so of those, that'll be enough to get past. So whenever I ask people where these are taking place, they all say Yemen, because it's the last one. You can't quite see that map that well, but you can sort of make out the landmasses, can't you? It's a little bit bright on there. So what we're looking at here is actually three categories. So the Burgundy are the major wars with over 10,000 deaths, sorry, in the last year. It's four colours. That's the Burgundy. The reds are the wars and the conflicts with 1,000 to up to 10,000 deaths. The orange are the minor skirmishes and conflicts with fewer than 1,000. And the yellow are the skirmishes and clashes with fewer than 100 deaths in the last year. But the numbers aside, look how many countries, how much of our landmass is suffering because of violence, because of conflict at the moment. Now, the UK isn't shown on there because, you know, technically there's not a war being fought in the country, but that actually makes it more interesting, doesn't it? Because, you know, look at North America, look at the UK, look at the countries that are missing from there. There is still violence within the boundaries of those countries. They may not technically be fighting a war on their own territory, but people are still being affected by it. When I did this talk one time, we were looking at the terrorist attack that happened in Paris. I think it was November 2015. And I asked if anyone had been affected by it. It turned out that one person in the audience had actually been in Paris in that area when that attack took place and had to go off to their hotel and sort of be holed up there for a while until everything was cleared. So you just never know, do you, who is going to be affected by these things? The point being, a lot of people around the world, whether we know them or not, are affected. And for some people, war, violence is part of day-to-day life. I think, hopefully, we're well blessed that we can move around freely, we can go to work, we can do what we need to do without suffering or feeling that we're going to be attacked by someone at any moment. But there are some people who don't have that luxury, that sort of freedom. So let's turn to the Bible and have a look at what the Bible has to say about war. I want to read an account of a battle which happens in Exodus chapter 17. So these are the verses. If you want to look that one up, that's fine. If you just want to listen, that's also fine. I'm going to read it. So Exodus 17, we're going to begin at verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek tomorrow. Fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. When he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side, the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar, and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, for he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Now, I normally like to do a bit of a demonstration of this, but I forgot to bring a heavy stick with me. So you have to imagine that I've brought someone up here, and I've asked them to hold this heavy stick above their head for as long as they possibly can. It's always fun to pick the kind of most macho-looking teenager for this as well. And after a while, of course, their arms start to get heavy, and you know, it's, no matter how strong you are, you can't hold your arms up forever without them getting tired. But this is what Moses was doing. He was holding up this stick, this staff, the rod of God, as he describes it in verse 9. And whenever he's able to hold it up, the Israelites prevail in the battle. They're sort of getting the better of the Amalekites, to put it that way. But when he tires and his hands come down, then the power shifts to the Amalekites, and they start to win the fight. And so eventually they put this stone and they sit him down so that Aaron and Hur can stand and they can help him support it. So Moses' arms are still up, the staff's still up, but he's having some support to help him do it because, of course, he can't keep his arms up that long. None of which really has that much to do with how the Israelites managed to win the battle, does it? Because the stick isn't what's making them win. It's God. God's in control of it. God's able to determine the outcome of a battle. He's able to give people a sign, something for them to latch onto as an act of faith, to say, look, while this is happening, this will happen. But ultimately, God's in control, and God can decide who's going to win. So God can determine the outcome of a fight, of a war. God can also stop it from happening at all in the first place, right? Well, let's have a look at that. Let's have a look at a few passages to teach us what the Bible's teaching us about war. Let's come to Acts chapter 1, first of all. Let's kind of just set the scene for this. So Acts chapter 1, this is all occurring after Jesus has been raised back from the dead after being crucified, and he's with his disciples now, and they ask him a question in verse 6. They say, in the middle of verse 6, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? So they're saying to him, okay, you've been through all this stuff, you've done what you said would happen, so are you going to set up the kingdom that you've promised us is going to come? And he says no. Well, he says, it's not for you, verse 7, to know the times or the seasons which the Father hath put in his own power. So here we're being reminded of God's power, that God is in control of all of these things. And then later on in the chapter, in verse 9, while they beheld, he, Jesus, was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven. So we're being told here that Jesus is going to set up God's kingdom in Israel, but it didn't happen then, because what happened then is Jesus went up into heaven to be with his Father, to be with God. But there's a time when he's going to come back in exactly the same way, as it says at the end of verse 11. He's going to come back from heaven to the earth, and it's that time when this kingdom will be set up on earth. Now, we won't go there now, but in Daniel chapter 2, we have this amazing prophecy which ends, the big climax at the end of this prophecy is this same kingdom that's being talked about here, being set up on earth. And the important thing that it talks about there is that this kingdom is going to fill the whole earth. It's going to be sort of the end of all of the kingdoms, that this kingdom of God is going to be a single kingdom that covers the whole earth. And the bit I want us to look at in a bit more detail now is in Isaiah chapter 2. Let's read a little bit more about what that kingdom will be like in Isaiah chapter 2. Just turn there, please. We've only got a couple more references to look at in this part of the talk. So Isaiah chapter 2, and if we look at the very beginning of the chapter, the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and it should come to pass in the last days, so here we're talking about the same time, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people should go and say, come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. So it's talking about this kingdom, this God's kingdom, that Jesus will return to the earth to set up. And in that kingdom, there'll be no more war. Nations aren't going to fight each other anymore. They're going to take their instruments of war, their weapons, and they're going to turn them into agricultural equipment and things that are much more useful for them in this time. You look at how much we spend on defence in this country, and look at America as well, and their defence spending. We do that as a nation because we feel we have to be able to defend ourselves against other nations. But in a time where there's no more war, where there's no risk that another country is going to come and try and invade you, you don't need to do that. You don't need to build planes, aircraft carriers, tanks, guns, bombs, etc. All of those resources can be taken and put to things that are much more profitable. Now that sounds like a time that I'd like to be alive in. That sounds amazing. Something much better than the world that we're in at the moment. And don't turn this one up, but in Psalm 46, it says, come behold the works of the Lord, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. That's what God can do to weapons and to things that people use to fight battles. He can completely destroy them. But just turn over a few pages to Isaiah chapter 9. It's our last verse we're going to have a look at in this section. So we've talked about how there'll be an end to war. And it's just going to talk to us a little bit about how Jesus will reign on earth here in Isaiah chapter 9. So have a look at verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. We associate these words with the birth of Jesus. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment, with justice, from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So the key bit for us there at the end of verse 6, the Prince of Peace, and in verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. So there's our little summary about how God is going to bring an end to war and to violence here on earth. Jesus will return to the earth to set up God's kingdom, during which time there'll be an end to war, and Jesus will reign in peace here on earth. Now that sounds like a wonderful thing, doesn't it? It sounds like a time that I think we'd all like to be there, to be part of that time. It's just so different from what we have at the moment. And as we move on in our talk, let's sort of apply some of those same ideas to hunger as well. It's the second part of our talk. I think we're just about doing it right for time. So when someone mentions hunger as a problem, maybe your mind turns to things like this. And you think about these sorts of images of children that are starving in African countries, or maybe you have a look at these images, you've got a long-term drought, and you think about the animals that don't have enough to eat or drink. But I want us today to think about it a little bit more in terms of inequality. Okay, so think about this idea that some people have more than others. That's how we're going to focus this. So has anyone ever seen this book before? It's called Hungry Planet. No? No one's got a copy? Okay. All right, well, not to worry. It's a really interesting book. We're going to have a look at it in a minute, so don't worry if you haven't read it. So the authors of this book, they travelled around the world and they took photos of families in different countries. You can't see it on here, actually. And the key part of the book, actually, as well as the text, is a portrait of each family surrounded by a week's worth of groceries, and then they included the amount of money that each family spends on food in a week. So we're going to play a little bit of a game here. We're going to put up one of these photos, and I'd like you to shout out how much you think that family spends on food in a week. So we'll start with this one, actually. And there's another thing, actually. Tell me which country you think it is as well. So let's even get the country first to make it easy. So what country is this?
The States.
It is. This is the United States of America. Here's the things that I thought gave it away, possibly did to you too. Lots of pizza. There's some Budweiser at the back, so it can't be anyone but the Americans. And then some Burger King and McDonald's down at the front as well. But the real question is, how much did that American family say they spent per week on food in US dollars, if you don't mind?
500.
Okay. So 140 and 500. That's quite a difference, isn't it, really? It's neither of those, but it's somewhere in between them. So good guesses, but unfortunately both wrong.
300.
So 300 is a lot closer. So yeah, a little bit more than 300?
400.
A little bit less. So it's about $350, so somewhere in the middle of the two of you. So, okay, so we've got a kind of baseline. Now, what I will say is all of the amounts in this book seemed really high to me. So I don't know if you spent anywhere near $350 a week on food. Probably couldn't afford it with the pound where it is at the moment. But it certainly isn't our family food budget. So just bear that in mind as we go through. So what country do you think this one is?
UK.
It's not the UK, no.
France.
It's not France, it is in Europe, so...
Eastern Europe?
It's not Eastern Europe, no.
Scandinavia?
No.
Germany?
Italy?
It's Italy. It's Italy. You've got a very Italian-looking gentleman there. You've got lots of sauce there in the middle for the pasta. And then you've got the pasta itself down the front, so very obviously Italy, I think. So how much did the Italian family spend per week on food?
In what currency?
In dollars. They put it all in dollars, so you can compare one with the other.
200.
Yes, good guess. A little bit more than 200, but you're in the right sort of ballpark.
250.
Yeah, so 250. I mean, they said 260. I'll accept 250. It's a good answer. So about $260 per week on food. So, okay, what about this family? Where do these guys live? It's a good guess, actually. It's not, but I can sort of see why you would think that.
South America.
It's Southern Hemisphere, it's not South America.
Not Australia.
It absolutely is Australia. And I'll tell you why I think there's a massive giveaway. There's a huge amount of meat for the Barbie. The woman is only a few corks shy of an Australian hat, and there's a kangaroo on the thing hanging there. Look, you can see it. Actually, the other thing I think a few of you missed is there's a bit of Australian wildlife creeping into the country as well. But, so how much do Australians spend on food in a week?
400.
Okay, 400. Really, really, really close. A bit less, but very good. Very good guess.
380.
Yeah, okay, so 376. I'm surprised you can guess 376. It's an obvious number to guess, isn't it? So $376. Okay, and the last family we're going to look at is this group. So where do you think they are? They're not in the UK.
Germany.
They are in Germany, yes. Just look at the sheer amount of beer, and there's German writing on the pizzas. So how much did the German family spend on food?
420.
Less than that?
380.
A little bit less?
350.
And still less?
320.
Yeah, so 320-ish on food. So, okay, so we've got that. We're happy with that game. You all enjoyed that. You can see from the smiles on the inside, everyone had a great time. So these are developed nations where people are clearly able to spend a lot of money on food, but also have access to a wide range of food products. And that's why I put this one last, actually, because I think this one, more than any of the others, demonstrates the range of foods that we have access to in the countries, the type of countries we live in. These are all fairly wealthy countries, aren't they? They've got some good fresh veg at the back and fruit at the front. They've got some kind of packaged goods and pre-made stuff as well. They've got fresh meat. They've got access to a wide range of things to drink as well. So I think that, you know, is fairly well balanced, isn't it? You know, I wouldn't be unhappy if someone said, this is your food for a week. I think there's quite a lot of different things in there that you could eat and enjoy. So we're now going to have a look at a couple of developing nations. So we've looked at developed, we're going to look at developing now. I won't ask you to guess where they are because it can be quite challenging to guess. But I'd like you to guess what their weekly food budget is. So this is Mali. Sorry, was there a number shouted? 25 and 20. So you're almost exactly right. $26.39. It gets very precise with Mali. Was their weekly food budget. So a couple of things. I think there's not such a range of things to eat in the photograph, and there seems to be a lot more people in that family than in all the others that we looked at. So they're feeding sort of extended family there, I think, as well on that budget. And the last one we'll look at is Chad. So what do we think they spent in Chad?
$15.
So a bit less than 15, who said that?
12.
A bit less than 12 as well?
10.
A little bit less than 10, keep going guys. We'll get there. Less than 8.
$5.
Less than 5.
$3.55.
Less than $3.55, but good guess, I like it.
$2.
So a little bit less than 2, but you're getting very close now.
$1.89.
We'll stop there because you're still too high, but I don't think we're going to get the exact number. $1.23. Which apparently buys you access to a small amount of what looks like possibly some dried fruit or vegetables here. Lots of grain. I assume these are water containers behind them as well. But I will leave that up there for a minute because it's quite shocking, isn't it, the level of inequality in the world. And I don't want to shame anyone, of course. You know, we're probably all going to go home to a really nice lunch today, aren't we? But perhaps when we do that, we can spare a thought for those who, in much tougher conditions, you know, we think it's hot today, it's probably a good 15 or 20 degrees hotter where they are, in much worse conditions, have access to much less food, can afford to spend much less on it, and have a family to bring up. You know, the little girl sitting over here, you know, she's a little girl like any other little girl in the world, but she's surviving in a much tougher environment. So I want us to think of inequality in terms of we'll look at food in terms of inequality. There are families in some countries who spend several hundred times what other families can do. Now, I think we've got time to do a very quick visual representation of this, and to do that I need to get 5 volunteers to come and stand over here. So either I'll volunteer you or volunteer yourselves, I really don't mind how you do it. But if we can just get 5 people to come and stand over this side in a line, that would be amazing. Otherwise I'll just start picking. I think you should, Sam, you should probably come as well. Okay, yeah, I've got David from the back by you coming along. And just one more person. Would it be okay to get a female? Is that okay? Would anyone object? It just seems a bit unbalanced at the moment. You know, I feel like our society is already a bit male dominated. No? We'll just get one more, okay? Yeah, there we go, brilliant.
Right, two have got to disappear to get the brothers and sisters from Eden House. That's why.
I see.
It's not that they didn't want to stand
up.
No,
that's fine, that's fine, that's fine. Okay. So what I need to do now is divide you into 2 groups. So I've got 5 people, so I'm going to take 20%, but I'll take one whole person rather than 20% of each person. So who looks the richest? No, let's not answer that question. So I want one person, perhaps if you could just come and stand on the platform. You can be developed nations. You can be the 20% of people in the world who live in developed nations, and the other 4 are going to be the 80% who live in the developing nations, okay? And what I've got here is our world's food supply represented by fruit drops. They're apparently a sweet shop favourite. So I'm going to divide these up the way that our food divides up in the world. So if we can start with you, if you hold your hands together. So obviously I've got 2 bags. So this is half the world's food that I'm going to pour in your hands. Try not to drop anything, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've got half the world's food there. But I'm going to give you a little bit more because you are the richest country. Even though there's hardly anyone living in you compared to the rest of the world, so you're also going to get all of these. And actually, a few more, if you order those as well. And maybe just one more. But don't worry, you guys, you get these, so maybe you can hold this. You get those to share. I mean, they're not just for Sam. So 80% of the world gets that much food, while 20% gets this much food. And I suppose the only question I want to ask now for this interactive part is, does anyone here think that that is a fair way to divide up our food in the world? I don't think it is. What would be a fair way to divide it?
Less than
everyone to have the same. That's how it breaks down right now. You've got 17% of the world's population, not even 20%, consuming 80% of the food, and 83% of the world's population consuming just 20% of the food. So please go and sit down, take the sweets, if you could just pass them round or something, let everyone share them. I'm trusting you to do this.
Equally.
Or just give everyone a sweet or two or something. You can have those, I don't mind. So sort of pass those around, because we're going to turn to the Bible and have a look at what the Bible has to say about hunger in the last 5 minutes or so. So if you haven't got your hands full of sweets, turn up Matthew chapter 14, please. So in Matthew chapter 14... we have this this account, which we often call the feeding of the 5,000, or as we rather pedantically labelled the colouring sheet at Sunday school, the feeding of the at least 5,000, which I thought was a nice touch. So let's read this. It starts in verse 13 of Matthew chapter 14. When Jesus heard of it, and he's hearing about the death of John the Baptist, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart, and when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. Thank you, Dylan. Brilliant job. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, "This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." But Jesus said unto them, "They need not depart. Give ye them to eat." And they said unto him, "We have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He said, "Bring them hither to me." And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass, and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake, and gave the loaves to his disciples, and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled. And they took of the fragments that remained 12 baskets full. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 men, beside women and children. So here, on a relatively small scale, we can see God's ability to create food, to provide for the hungry. We had a group of at least 5,000 people who were hungry. There was a very small amount of food. Now, if we'd have done this demonstration with that group, you'd have had one person eating all the loaves and all the fish and everyone else going hungry. But that's not what Jesus did. That's not what God wanted. Miraculously, using God's power, Jesus was able to create enough food for everyone to share it out equally amongst everyone and still have some left over at the end, which is also another part of the miracle. But the point being, all of those people were fed by God. So what else does the Bible teach us about food and about equality? So no need to turn all of these up. I think for speed I'll just kind of read these to you. But in Mark chapter 12, we have a little story where Jesus sees people giving money for the poor. And he sees the rich people, and they're throwing in lots and lots of money, and they're making a big show of it. And then in verse 42 of Mark 12, there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in 2 mites, which make a farthing. And Jesus called unto him his disciples, and he said unto them, "Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living." And the point that's being made here is, it doesn't matter how much you have to give, give all that you have. Salvation from God is available to all, irrespective of your financial means. Now, back in Isaiah, okay, you don't need to necessarily turn all of these up, but chapter 35. I'm just read you a couple of verses. Again, we're talking about this time of the kingdom that we looked at in the first half. Isaiah chapter 35, verse 1, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose." And verse 7, "The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons, where each lay, shall be grass with reeds and rushes." And it's over a couple of pages, Isaiah chapter 41. Verse 18, "I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittim, and the myrtle, and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together." We're reading about a time in the kingdom when the whole world is able to sustain life, where people can live all around the world and they can all rejoice and worship God together. And then for our last but one reference in Isaiah chapter 65, This one just relates to the inequality aspect we looked at. Isaiah 65, verse 21. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. So another vision of this kingdom is a time of equality, where people build a house and live in it. They don't slave to build for someone else. They plant a vineyard and they eat the fruit from it themselves. They don't work and slave for someone else. And all this is to come in God's kingdom when Jesus returns to the earth. And the last point really for us is, how can we be part of it? And I suppose we should end with this message that gives us in Mark chapter 16, that he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. So a very quick summary then. We've got a world that is full of problems. We only went back a month and we've covered several problems in the world around us. God has demonstrated time and time again that he's in control. He's in control of wars and fighting. He's in control of food. He's told us that Jesus will be sent back to the earth to establish God's kingdom here. And we've seen that we can be part of it. So let's hope that 2017 brings about the return of Jesus to end the suffering in the world caused by war, to end the suffering in the world caused by hunger and the inequality that we see around us. Thank you very much.